From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a cold fall day in Wilmington, Delaware, in the late 1990s. The chief financial officer for a company was driving to work. The company called AppleTree Answers, which employed more than 600 people. 85% of those workers were hourly, while the remaining 15% were salaried. The CFO, of course, was a salaried worker. On the way to work, the CFO hit a pothole, which blew out her front right tire and damaged the rim. No problem. The CFO called AAA, which sent a tow truck, brought her to her nearby Mercedes dealership. She picked up a loaner car and headed off to work. She got to work about 90 minutes late, and the staff offered sympathy and brought her coffee for her ordeal. A few days later, another employee of the same company hit the same pothole. Same result to the car, but this employee was one of the 85% of hourly workers. She was not a AAA member. She had to call a friend to ask for a ride to work, since she couldn't afford a cab. She got to work 3 hours late and received a reprimand from her supervisor, a dock in pay, and a warning that she would be fired if she was late again. Later that day, she got the bill for her car's damage. It was more than she brought home in 4 full work days, and she couldn't pay it. She wondered how she would get to work the next day, let alone get her kids to school. As described in a book called The Healing Organization, the CEO of the company came to see these two stories as deeply unfair. He told co-author Raj Sisodia, quote, "We were so empathetic to our CFO, and we reined all over the other person for whom this was a huge deal. We took her bad day and made it a lot worse. It is totally backward. There was no empathy at all for the person who needed it most." End quote. This company story is one of many that filled the pages of the Healing Organization, which is a call to business to make serious changes in how workers are treated, in how customers are treated, even in how success is defined. The authors write about AppleTree, quote, "CEO John Ratliff realized that he was presiding over 2 different working environments within the same company, one that people never wanted to leave, and the other in which people couldn't wait to escape," end quote. And Ratliff went on to say, quote, "You can imagine the kind of class warfare this caste system created. If you really want to have a horrible culture, have your salaried employees be happy and your hourly people be miserable," end quote. Does this sound familiar? How many companies treat the salaried employees well and the hourly employees as disposable? Is it realistic to think that a capitalistic society can push businesses to act with a spirit of generosity and empathy? Is there an incentive to do that? Our guests believe the answer is yes. Joining us this hour is the co-author of The Healing Organization, Raj Sisodia. He's a founding member of the Conscious Capitalism Movement. Raj, welcome to the program. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Evan. Delighted to be with you, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, glad to have you, and glad to have Andrew Brady, who's co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism and President and Chief Evolutionary Officer for the Accelerate team. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, Andrew, things have been changed up for you guys because you had a conference planned and you had a visit with Raj planned. You're still doing some stuff, but I know things have changed a bit. Tell us what's coming up here.
Yeah, so some of your listeners may remember that when you did the Books of the Year show, the Healing Organization was my book of the year, and I gave a little plug that we were bringing Raj to town that was supposed to be in May. Instead, to move into the virtual environment, rather than ask people to sit on a Zoom call all day long, which is tough to make engaging, instead we're going to do, throughout the month of July, we're going to have 1 hour every Wednesday at 3 p.m., a 1 hour panel or speaker, starting off with Bob Duffy and Rob Simpson, which is Bob's kind of counterpart of the chamber out in Syracuse, as well as Dr. Chanel Hawkins from the Urban League to talk about how we can heal our upstate economy. Then we're having Raj on the 8th to talk with us, you know, more in depth about the book and hopefully continue on this conversation that we'll have with you today. And then talking about how we can create a more inclusive entrepreneurial ecosystem. And then after that, talking how we can help to create organizational cultures that really heal.
All right. And how can they interact with you, Andrew, to kind of get in touch, learn more about how to get involved?
Yep. So ConsciousCapitalismROC.org. They can sign up, basically sign up for the conference. One of the great things about it being virtual is we have much lower costs, so it's free to attend. So we'd love to have people, anybody that's interested can attend and join and tell their friends. And even though we'll be talking about some upstate issues, I think all around the world, a lot of these things are really resonating.
Well, I wanted to start, Raj, with the story of AppleTree, because to me, this is maybe the single most relatable thing from the Healing Organization, which is that workers often feel like there is a caste system, as Ratliff said, that there is a preference for a small subset of workers, and the rest of workers are viewed very differently. Maybe they don't get benefits. Maybe they are, sort of kept part-time. I mean, there's a lot of different things that happen, not just pay. But the reason this one stands out to me is you actually had the CEO look at these stories and decide, on its face, it was unfair, but that there might even be an incentive to do it better. And the thing that I think stands in the way of making wide-scale change in a capitalistic society is most CEOs won't see an incentive to make a change. This system works for most companies, or they perceive it to work, whether it's fair or not. Is there enough incentive to get things going in the direction you want to see, Raj?
Well, yes, but, you know, we tend to think of incentives purely in monetary terms. You know, there's also ethical, moral, humanistic considerations. You know, if you are a feeling human being, you're going to see the suffering that is out there, and you will be moved by it if you open your eyes. You know, as James Baldwin said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And the reality is that most CEOs and most senior leaders have no idea what life is like for the vast majority of people they employ. And this idea of a caste system, you know, I'm originally from India, and one of the sort of darkest things about India is the caste system. And we have another story in the book called Jaipur Rugs, which also kind of deals with that issue. But, but the fact is that in our country, here, the richest country in the world, the largest economy by far, and even before the current pandemic, we were at a time of economic boom. The stock market was at record highs. Unemployment was below 4%. The reality was, even then, that about two-thirds of people were living paycheck to paycheck, and 50% had less than $400 in the bank. And if they needed $2,000 within 30 days, would not be able to come up with it. So people were living that close to financial ruin or disaster. You know, one small incident, your car, your heating system, or your kid gets sick and you don't have insurance. And, you know, just even if those things don't happen, living with that dread, that causes tremendous stress. And that leads to all kinds of physical illnesses as well. I think 80-90% of physical conditions are caused or certainly manifested by stress. And therefore, the impact on ordinary people is extraordinary. So it's not just the financial. There's, of course, many other aspects of how we work and how we treat people in companies. It's causing an epidemic, I would say, of silent suffering for the most part. You know, until recently, that suffering wasn't visible. People weren't out on the streets protesting. But when 40 years of flat wages, and in some ways, if you measure it in certain ways, it's really declining, wages for workers in this country, even as executive pay went up 1,000% in that time. There's something wrong with the way our system has been operating. You know, American-style capitalism is not working for most Americans, and hence we see all the unrest and the rise of populism and so forth. There's a lot of real pain out there, and this book is an attempt to shine a light on that suffering. The first part of the book, which most people don't even realize how much suffering there is, when heart attacks are 20% higher on Mondays, when 120,000 Americans die every year just from the way we work, not the work itself, but the stress. When 600,000 Chinese die every year from overwork. You know, the human cost of doing business is nowhere measured. It doesn't show up on an income statement or a balance sheet. It may be the largest cost. And what's the impact on children and families when people are stressed out and burned out at work? And how are we treating our customers? There's just a whole lot of suffering that is unnecessary, doesn't serve any higher purpose. And this book is an illustration of how we don't have to cause suffering with work. We actually can do the opposite. We can reduce suffering and elevate joy every day through how we operate.
Well, and if I could, let me at least offer... I don't think it's necessarily a criticism, but it's maybe a concern I have with the idea that this is sort of a scalably a scalable operation, that society can be populated with businesses that are largely led in these directions. Here's the concern I have. You've got people like NKC. You know, when you talk about Jaipur Rugs, you talk about people like, I think it's pronounced Nankishore Chaudhary. People like NKC, who you write about in your book, or even people like the CEO of AppleTree, people who see unfairness in their own companies and decide that that cannot stand. And they are extraordinary. I mean, you're right that NKC is one of the most unusual CEOs in the world, which makes for a great story. The concern I have is these companies that you're profiling, Jaipur, AppleTree, others, are often led by these unusual people, unusually feeling people. And conversely, there's been some discussion. I had a conversation with a neuroscientist a few years back on this program who said that nonviolent psychopathy, you know, exists in a small percentage of the population, and it actually leads to quite a few people end up in corner offices because they are, you know, very good at the bottom line, and they know how to get the bottom line cranked up and shareholders happy, and that puts them in positions of leadership in companies. So you've got a lot more people maybe in that direction than you have of the NKCs or even the people like Ratliff, right? And when I asked you what's the incentive for businesses to go in the directions led by the people like NKC, you went away from money. You went to all of these other reasons that workers are suffering that I think a lot of people agree with. But I don't think most companies are moving unless they see a monetary gain in that direction. Do you disagree?
I do not disagree, but the point I wanted to make is that we act like money is the only game in town.
Sure.
And there are other games in town that matter even more to human beings. But however, money, so my whole journey in this direction began with a book called Firms of Endearment that came out in 2007. And it really arose out of my frustration with the traditional story of business. And I was looking for a better way. You know, the traditional story is only about making money. It's only about using people, maximizing profits. We even exploit our customers. We do all kinds of fancy, you know, tricks with marketing and promotions and sales. We were spending $1 trillion a year on marketing in 2004, which was equal to the GDP of India, you know. A billion people were managing to live on what we were spending on ads, coupons, and junk mail. So I was looking for a better way. And I kind of stumbled upon this other paradigm of business, which was rooted in a higher purpose, and caring for all of your stakeholders. And hence the name Firms of Endearment. Customers love these companies. Employees love them. Communities, you know, Trader Joe's, Patagonia, Whole Foods, REI, Wegmans in your backyard, mm-hmm. Wonderful company. Loved by everybody. Employees love them. Customers love them. Suppliers love them. You know, community, everybody, right? So there is a model, or there's a way of thinking which actually is nowhere in the business school curriculum. It's nowhere in the playbook that has been prescribed for capitalism, right? But it does exist. Some of these companies are 100 years old. In India, we have a company called the Tatas that started in 1865, you know, with many of these healing and conscious principles. So in any case, in Firms of Endearment, we identified 28 companies which followed this, and we kind of uncovered these operating principles, right? Higher purpose, stakeholder orientation, leaders who care about people and purpose ahead of power and ego and money, and cultures that are rooted in trust and love. And people love going to work at these companies, right? And so we discovered that pattern, and then we found companies that fit that pattern. So Whole Foods was one of those companies that we found, and others. And Wegmans was in that book. And then at the end, we did the financial analysis, and we said, you know, these companies are paying their people well, in case many times double. Like Costco at that time was paying double of Walmart, and 60% higher than Sam's Club. Container Store was paying double, right? You know, we have HEB in the new book, and their mantra is, please pay our people as much as possible. That's what the chairman of the company told his executives. Create a business model predicated around the fact that we want to pay our people as well as we can so that they can live well. So these companies were paying their people better. They were providing great customer care. They were providing, you know, they were paying their suppliers well. Their suppliers were profitable. They're investing in their communities, investing in the environment, and they were paying taxes at an average rate of 34%, okay, when most companies were paying in single digits on average. And so we said maybe their financial performance is less because investors get paid last, right, in our system. Everybody else gets paid, and then what's left is the investors. But what we actually found was these companies outperformed the market by a 9-to-1 ratio over a 10-year period. It was 1,025% returns for the public companies in that group. compared to the S&P, which had gone up 125% in those 10 years. So this made it an even more compelling story that it's not a trade-off or a choice between being good to people and good for the world and good for society and good for our collective future or making a lot of money. It actually says that the path to true wealth, you know, there's false wealth and there's true wealth. True wealth is where you are creating economic wealth alongside at least seven other kinds of wealth. And false wealth is when you are squeezing and extracting from your employees, from your communities, from your suppliers, and damaging the ecosystem and the planet, etc., and you're squeezing all that out. Those businesses, to me, they're not real businesses. That's a parasite. You're sucking out value. You're not creating value. Right? So, again, 9-to-1 outperformance, and that's our research. I did a second edition of that book in 2014 with 72 companies, much more data-driven approach. And we found 7.7 times outperformance over a 15-year period, right? So, again, there's compelling evidence, not just from my research, but there's lots of it out there that we can point to that says this is the better way to do business. And it, in the long term, it does create result in superior financial value creation as well.
Well, and this is probably an unfair question, kind of impossible to answer, but I just want your best guess. If you had to guess, companies in the United States, how many would you put in the parasite category? What percentage?
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. I think, you know, we're almost by law, or people think that by law, you know, the definition of fiduciary responsibility, they think is shareholder value maximization, that the CEO and the board have to be fiduciaries for the organization. That actually is not correct, right? The duty of executives and boards is to the well-being of that corporation. And that corporation includes its shareholders, but it also includes employees and customers and all the other stakeholders. But because we are enthralled to that paradigm, right, because we think Milton Friedman is God, and he said in 1970 that the only social responsibility of business is to increase its profits, and then we have all these business school professors like Jensen and Meckling and others who created all these theories, right, agency theory and other things around that whole premise. You know, in business schools, it is gospel that shareholder value maximization is.
And still is gospel, right?
It still is. I mean, I taught strategy for 20 years. I never used the word purpose because the purpose was given to us. The purpose is to maximize profits and shareholder value. Now figure out how to do it, right? And now that seems so hollow. So, but I would say that because that is the dominant paradigm, I would say that probably and certainly among public companies, I would say a majority, 60-70% mm-hmm. are probably operating in that way, even though they might be doing lip service to CSR and, you know, customer corporate social responsibility and some green initiatives and so forth. But if you look at the overall impact that they're having, they are still extracting value, not creating as much value.
Well, and Andrew Brady, here's why I asked that question. Andrew is, of course, a fan and well acquainted with Nick Hanauer, who a very wealthy guy who wrote a piece maybe 5 years ago in which he predicted that the pitchforks are coming. And if I'm going to sum up what Nick Hanauer said, he's essentially saying that if business leaders don't get their act together and treat workers better, pay them more, give them better benefits, give them a better, bigger share of the pie and not concentrate all the wages at the top, then there's going to be sort of a takeover by force in some form or another. And extending Hanauer's idea, Andrew, when I read The Healing Organization and I listen to Raj make the case for doing business this way, I tend to think that the clock is kind of ticking and that this model is either going to be where we go, or there's going to be maybe not a pitchforks revolution, but there will be, you know, it's the reason that Democratic Socialists of America have done better in recent elections and are growing their ranks, and more progressives are moving further left because they don't trust capitalism. We saw a whole Democratic primary that nearly went that way, and we could see it again. And I think that we're close to that tipping point. Do you feel that that's right, Andrew?
I do. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think that as Raj was talking about, you know, there are customers that more and more are voting with their dollars, right? They want to be conscious consumers. There's more and more employees that are demanding this, especially the younger set. They want to work for, you know, these purposeful companies. And so there are ways that, you know, and then those employees stay around longer and they're more engaged and they work harder. So there's ways that it does impact the bottom line. But Raj made an interesting point earlier mentioning how, especially among publicly traded companies, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes to be conscious. And in a lot of ways, that I think is what needs to change, is some of the kind of more economic wide and societal maybe incentives need to be tweaked or changed so that it becomes easier, both easier to do conscious business and harder for the, you know, what Raj sometimes calls the crony capitalist to extract value from the economy, because I think that's kind of the place that we're in. And, you know, like stockholders, we call them owners, but really they're more like renters, right? Like they're renting a company for a while. Many of them aren't going to be invested in that company for the long term. They're going to hold the stock for a little while. And so think about the kind of incentive. Think about if you rent a car, you don't treat that car as well as you do the car that you own. And so I think part of that is the problem is this short-term thinking that happens that kind of in the ownership structures and in finance and in some ways that it does make it harder to do conscious capitalism. And I agree, you know, that there's recent study that maybe a couple years ago now where, you know, Harvard showed that more millennials believed in socialism than capitalism. So this is a moment where capitalism has to reform itself, or it may be a bigger change.
Let me get our first phone call of the hour of a listener who's maybe skeptical of that. Go ahead, Kayla.
Hi. I just really kind of feel like conscious capitalism is a bit of an oxymoron, and I'm not really sure why we're continuing to prop up these systems of oppression that have been proven not to work. There's a great quote from Angela Davis where she says, as long as we inhabit a capitalist democracy, a future of racial equality, gender equality, and economic equality will elude us. You know, capitalism was built on equality, inequality, and the system cannot be reformed because that inherent value and motivation is at the central core of this system. And it really prevents us from having a deeper conversation that we need to be having about a complete system overhaul. And, you know, I just think that if we're talking about reforming capitalism, we're not talking about the real issue, which is capitalism isn't working and we need a new system.
Kayla, stay there for a second, and let me let both of our guests respond, and I'll start with Raj Sisodia. Go ahead, Raj.
Yeah, no, I think that definitely we have to elevate capitalism with new consciousness. You know, any tool can be used with different consciousness. A surgeon can use a scalpel to save my life and somebody else can use it to kill me, right? Capitalism is one of the most powerful tools ever invented by human beings to harness and channel the energies of vast numbers of people towards collective ends. And there's no denying the fact that in the last two centuries when this system really came about, after Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, that every indicator of human well-being, most of them, have gone up dramatically. Per capita incomes, 1,500%. Life expectancy has gone from about 28 to about 74. Literacy has gone from 13% to 87%. And the percentage of people living in abject extreme poverty was 90% in the year 1800. It's about 9% last year. It's probably gone up a little bit now, right? And the fact is that this is a system that has done a lot for billions of people, and we don't want to throw it out, right? We need to celebrate what it can do, but we need to elevate it with a higher consciousness as we human beings evolve on our journey on this planet. What we don't want to do is decimate it. We know that other systems which are rooted in government control and ownership do not work, okay? And that debate, we have to, I mean, you know, some version of a reformed capitalism, you can call it, you know, the Scandinavian model or whatever it might be, but this conscious capitalism to me is the answer, and not replacing this. Nobody has come up with an alternative, say, okay, let's go to socialism. That's bipolar thinking, right? We don't need to go one or the other. As Jonathan Haider said, this is about dynamism versus decency, right? Capitalism promises and delivers dynamism. You know, no socialist economy would have invented an iPhone, right? Great companies are precious social organizations. They do things to move us forward in the world in ways that other systems do not, other entities cannot, right? So dynamism, capitalism promises and delivers dynamism. Creative destruction, new industries get created. I mean, you're living in Rochester. What happened to Kodak? What happened to Xerox, right? I mean, that's part of the bargain with capitalism. You could prop up those companies and keep them alive, but that's not how technology moves forward. Socialism promises decency. But unfortunately, a truly socialistic system with government ownership and control does not deliver, and we have, you know, numerous examples of that. However, decency is a very important human value. And what we want is dynamism with decency. We cannot survive without dynamism. We have to reinvent every aspect of our life in the next 100 years. The way we get our energy, the way we get our food, the way we, you know, get our housing and travel, everything, because the old model was predicated on limited resources, right? So we need more dynamism than ever, but we care about decency. And this is a way to really bring about dynamism with decency. People have jobs that are meaningful and purposeful and joyful, right? And they're not getting a handout. They actually have a sense of achievement and worth. Right, and we're doing things that are impactful and they were healing our environment, et cetera. All of that can be done through business alongside working cooperatively with the nonprofit sector and the government. But business has to be the lead actor in that, I believe, because it is the dominant entity in free market systems.
And Kayla, can I just ask Kayla if what you are saying is even if business can do that, systemically it is incentivized not to most of the time in this system. Is that what you're arguing?
Absolutely. And I would argue that businesses do not need to be the leader. The people need to be the leader. Why are we having, you know, when Steve Jobs was alive, heads of these huge corporations? Great, we have an iPhone, but to what cost? You know, I don't believe that business leaders need to run the world. They're accountable to no one. They're not elected officials, and they don't represent the people.
Well, they are elected in a way because you choose to work there and you choose to buy from them and you choose to invest in them and so forth, right? So there is voluntary exchanges at the heart of this system, which is what gives it its power. See, a government has coercive power, and a government can put you in jail or kill you, right? The government has a monopoly on violence. If you don't agree with something they're saying, and it might be perfectly acceptable where you live and 100 miles away, it's not, and you could get killed for the exact same thing, right? Businesses do not have that. Businesses in a well-regulated system, and I agree with the need for government regulation. We don't want monopolies. We don't want excessive concentration of power. But all businesses can offer you is the opportunity to engage in a voluntary exchange. If you think you're going to be better off buying that product from me, you should do so. Then both of us are better off through that exchange. Likewise with employment, likewise with investment, likewise with supplying, et cetera, right? So when this system works well, it is fantastic. It creates orders of magnitude more value coming out than what went into it. And I think we have no choice but to reform it and elevate it. We don't have to be stuck by the words. The word capitalism was coined by Karl Marx, right? And I do acknowledge, and I've written elsewhere, you know, socialism, communism, Marxism, none of these ideas existed on this planet until we had the abuses of capitalism. We had, you know, the factory conditions that were horrific and workers were dying and Carnegie was, you know, hiring the Pinkertons to open fire on protesting and striking workers. I mean, we had tremendous abuse, right? And that's what then gave rise, you know, sort of socialism and communism. These are sort of the, you know, the stepchildren of capitalism in a way that were rejected and denied. They were all asking for was dignity and good working conditions, right? So there's a lot of history there to overcome, but the system itself, the core idea of it is rooted in Adam Smith's insight that countries that do better are rooted in greater individual freedom. Right? And individuals are free to pursue their passions and create organizations and companies, et cetera, to express themselves in the world. Right? What we left out, and Kayla, I think this may be the missing piece that all of us feel, and I've written a book about this. You know, Adam Smith also wrote another book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was about the human need to care. You know, we are as much driven by the need to care as we are driven by self-interest. Wealth of Nations was about self-interest and achievement and building something and creating all this, right? And the theory of moral sentiments was about caring. And that's kind of that nurturing, caring, compassion, you know, some call it the feminine energy. You know, it's not about male-female, it's about masculine-feminine, right? We left that out of capitalism, right? It was all about self-interest, and that soon became selfishness and greed. But if we factor in caring, which is what conscious capitalism is about, so these are businesses built on love and care. Right? If we factor that in, then we don't have all of those challenges. So in our country, capitalism and democracy both evolved without the participation of women and feminine energy. You know, women did not have the right to vote, as we know, until 100 years ago. 140 years we had this country without women having the right to vote, right? So we left out that feminine energy, that caring, compassion, empathy, etc. You know, that's what I mean by feminine energy, right? That's what's missing. That's what's needed to balance the world today. That's what's needed in business and in government and every societal institution. And if we do that, if we become whole human beings, You know, as Carl Jung said, every man has an inner woman, every woman has an inner man. And I don't mean to be binary in my use of gender language, but, you know, we're talking about those energies, right, that prevail in all of us. If we go forward with that sense of wholeness, then we actually can address all of the challenges that we're talking about. And still we're doing it in the context of freedom and voluntary exchange. We don't want to have servitude to government.
But Raj, let me just ask one more quick question to sort of continue what was Kayla's interrogation of capitalism. And by the way, you've lit up our phones, which just indicates, I'll have Andrew Brady tell you again shortly, how you can get more involved in participating here with what they've got coming up with Raj. But, you know, to Kayla's point about what business can do but tends not to in this system, there's a section of the book where you point out that, I think it was the Iroquois Confederation, talk about seven generations ahead, and a company, was it Unilever, I think, that or maybe Unilever acquired a company that had the same kind of mantra, not to just think for now, but to create a cleaner world, a better world for this generation and literally seven generations ahead. I love that. I love the idea. However, we also have a system right now, and I think Kayla's point would be, where we incentivize, well, what's your next quarter profits going to be? What can you do for your next quarterly earning report? We had a financial crash in 2008, 2009, because we have incentivized people on Wall Street to create instruments in which they were ticking time bombs, sliced up and hidden in really complex documents. But when the bomb went off, they got the money. They didn't go to jail. They got the money. So they got the short-term profit that came from creating these bombs, and everyone else got hammered. And there wasn't a consequence. And people like Kayla are saying, I love what you're doing, trying to push them in that direction, but does the system just too strongly incentivize the opposite, Raj?
Yeah, definitely it does. And I agree there's need for massive structural reform and systemic change, right? Because the government's job is to create the system within which the right kinds of activities will occur and flourishing can happen, right? And so one of those big things that's happening right now, which is a very positive indicator, there's a new stock exchange being formed called the Long-Term Stock Exchange, LTSE, and your listeners can look that up. And it's actually been approved already, and they're moving forward to the next stage. And the idea there is that it will empower people who hold on to their shares for a longer time. So speculators who buy shares today and then put pressure on companies to do certain things to maximize their short-term returns would be disempowered under that. The longer you hold your shares, the more actual power you would have to guide and influence the direction of that company, right? And so it would discourage speculation and encourage true investment, right? Investment, by definition, is long-term. Short-term investment is speculation. That's not even investment. So we need to have reforms of that kind. Right? We need to change our capital gains taxation structure to discourage short-term speculation, et cetera. Right? So there are things like that that can be done. But what I want to caution against is let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Right? If we do a wholesale replacement, we tend to be bipolar, as I said. We go from one extreme to the other. If it's not capitalism, you know, like Venezuela went from extreme cowboy capitalism to extreme doctrinaire socialism, and look at what has gotten them. What we need is the capacity to hold both of these poles together. It's called polarity thinking, right? Not bipolar, but hold these polarities. Yes, we want the benefits of capitalism, and we want what socialism is ultimately inspired by, decency, right? We want people to be cared for. And yes, there should be a social safety net. And yes, a lot of us believe in universal health care, et cetera, and, you know, there's a role for government and all of that, right? So we have to figure out the system. But at the core of it, we want to make sure that we preserve that capacity for people to express their entrepreneurial energies, their sort of divine creativity that we are born with, and a system that harnesses that for the common good is really ultimately what's going to elevate us, right? As opposed to putting us all into boxes and saying, okay, you just do everything like everybody's like everybody else, and everybody gets paid the same, and there's no real incentive, not just financial, but otherwise, for people to really explore what they're capable of. You know, there's an expression, this planet used to be molten lava, and today it sings opera. You know, where does that come from? It comes from human beings being able to explore their higher potential. And when most people were living in extreme abject poverty, that didn't happen. 90% of people never had the chance to explore that. So I think we want to create systems that promote that, that elevate our lives so that we can explore what it means to be human.
I got to let Andrew Brady jump in here, and then what we're going to do is we'll take our only break of the hour, and we will just finish the hour with the many listener comments, and we could have done this all day. But go ahead, Andrew Brady.
So I think it's really interesting. You know, Raj mentioned it as one example, you know, climate change, right? Like we're going to need an incredible amount of innovation in order to, you know, in order to save ourselves, essentially. And that innovation is unlocked by a market system, by capitalism, where people are pursuing these different ideas. And now, in addition to climate change, I would say that the other most important issue of our time, you know, for our economy is inequality, both racial inequality and economic inequality. And I think that what Raj mentioned that sometimes gets lost is that Adam Smith had this, yes, you know, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regards to their own self-interest, which is the most quoted thing he ever written and is in The Wealth of Nations. But he also wrote The Moral Sentiments, which was about this more caring, this more conscious version of capitalism, and being able to balance those is really important. And I'd just add as well that, you know, the Scandinavian countries that sometimes get raised up as socialists, it's really what they have is that they have a very strong safety net, and then they unleash the market on top of that to have a very capitalist, very innovative, you know, type of economy. And so, you know, I agree in a lot of ways with many of the kind of reforms that Raj talked about, and I agree that we need a stronger safety net to lift everybody up. And I think that actually, as the Nordic countries have shown, that actually helps everyone because, you know, maybe you then will, if you're treated badly at your job, you won't be afraid to leave because you have a little bit of help there. Or, you know, you get an idea and you have the ability to go start a company because you don't have to worry about healthcare or things like that. John Holt Bryant, who we brought to Rochester a couple of years ago for one of our conferences, he talks about how, you know, there's a Steve Jobs in every zip code in America. And, you know, how many people that don't have those opportunities, you know, are we missing out on their innovations and what they could add? And so I do think, as Raj is mentioning, that when you marry the capitalism, you know, more self-interested piece with the conscious, more caring piece, that you do create an opportunity to tackle these changes, or these changes that we really need to tackle in terms of climate change and inequality, and really have that growth that is inclusive for in prosperity that is inclusive for everyone.
And to Andrew's point, by some of the innovation measures, some of the most innovative countries in the world are in Scandinavia. Andrew, the website for people to learn more about what's coming up with Raj and other events related to conscious capitalism in Rochester.
Yeah, so you can go to consciouscapitalismroc.org or you can search Conscious Capitalism ROC on Facebook. Just sign up. It's a free conference. It'll be once a week. It'll be throughout the Julys or throughout the Wednesdays in July at 3 p.m. And actually, we've had so many people reaching out and getting excited that we might be extending it into August. So love to hear that there's so many callers and so much interest.
Andrew Brady is the co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism and President and Chief Evolutionary Officer of the Accelerate Team. And Raj Sisodia is the author of The Healing Organization, Awakening the Conscience of Business to Help Save the World. He is the founding member of the Conscious Capitalism Movement. And after our only break, more of your phone calls for him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. Local colleges are making plans to be ready for students in the fall. This has been an ongoing series of conversations about going back to school. Soon we'll focus on K-12. Monday we focus on the college experience. New York State wants plans and guidelines in place soon. We're going to hear what local institutions are planning Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson and want to get back to your phone calls. Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing today?
Just fine, sir.
Yeah. In these discussions, I always hear this either or, talking about capitalism or socialism. But I don't think, first of all, I don't think any of us have ever lived in a capitalist system. Number one, we've all been in hybrid systems, and I believe that either one, to their nth degree, will fail miserably, socialism or capitalism. I think the issue is how do you find the sweet spot with the combination that is productive for for the entirety of your society. And that's what this discussion should be. It should not be a discussion of capitalism versus socialism, because the only place you find either one of them are in extreme conditions. And I think the language in the conversation has to be changed, because if you don't, you're going to constantly have this battle. And just real quick to one point that we're talking about, where the Iroquois Nation, plan for seven generations, that's nice when you live on the plains of America, that things don't change. But as the intervals of time that we use in our lives shrink, also change happens faster. So I don't think that's part of a conversation. You may have an overall overreaching vision of what you want your company to be, say, good for all humanity, but you can't plan seven generations in 210 years. So I don't think that's an extreme too. So we have these dichotomies that we always talk to, and I think the conversation is wrong. And as long as you keep these conversations going like this, we're going to have these battles.
So you're looking for the sweet spot. Yeah. I think that's more than fair, Rich. Thank you. So before I kick that to Raj, that lines up very closely with an email from Barry, who says, "Do you have a problem calling our system capitalism, a system of competition, when our capitalist system now features companies which are able to use their money to lobby and get laws which advantage them? The large companies destroy smaller entrepreneurs, thus creating their own monopolies. Our laws concerning international companies create a situation so that they can avoid American taxes. And they get these favorable tax laws because of their slush funds for lobbyists. They cheat average Americans in so many ways. Why are we calling this capitalism?" So I think it's similar to what Rich is saying. You know, really, what are we in now? And why do we only talk capitalism and socialism when he's looking for something sort of, as he calls, the sweet spot, Raj?
Yeah, so I agree with him entirely. It's not about either or. It's about getting the best of both, which is why we need this, as I said, instead of bipolar thinking, we need to understand polarity thinking, right? How both, like breathing in and breathing out, right? We need both, right? Decentralization and centralization, teamwork versus individual. It's not about going for one or the other. Let's get the best of both. I believe conscious capitalism tries to do that. As I said, it's about dynamism with decency, which is kind of the poles, right, that capitalism and socialism represent. And therefore, that is the kind of system that I think we are looking to evolve towards. In terms of the other comment, I agree entirely. So, you know, that is not capitalism. That is what we call crony capitalism or crapitalism. We also refer to it as crapitalism. And that's what most people who hate or dislike capitalism really are equating it with that. But I don't think we should. True capitalism is about true competition and a fair and level playing field. It's about the government not taking sides. It's about open, fair taxation and all of the rest of it, right? So we need to, and you know, not having all of this excessive power in lobbying and everything else that goes along with cronyism. That's, I think, the greatest danger. That is a cancer on society. We need to eliminate that and create actual, real free markets. But again, you know, leaven with this idea of purpose and caring and having consciousness and so forth. So we have dynamism and decency together. So I agree with both of your callers that this is the direction that we need to go towards. And that's what we've been trying to do. You know, our movement started in 2008, conscious capitalism. And if you look in 2019, it felt like we were approaching a tipping point. If you look at the Business Roundtable, which is the collection of 183 of the largest companies, they abandoned their long-standing definition of the purpose of business as only creating economic value. They said, no, it must create value for all stakeholders. It must treat people with respect and dignity, that every company should have its own purpose. Even the World Economic Forum in Davos issued in December what they call the Davos Declaration, which is around stakeholder capitalism and not shareholder capitalism. So there are movement, you know, I think we're approaching a kind of Berlin Wall moment here where the old way will simply be ridiculous on its face, that business only exists to make money. Like, how can you even argue that? I think we're getting to that point very quickly.
Hmm. Jerry in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hi, I think it's Gary.
Oh, Gary, go ahead. Yeah.
Hi. You know, in just the last few moments, two things were said that really struck me. One was that government shouldn't take sides. That's exactly wrong. Another one was that capitalism is moving right now. We're at a Berlin Wall moment. We're going to break through compassionate capitalism. That's utter nonsense. The reason capitalism works as well as it does is that it is single-minded. I went to business school also. It works so well because it has only one concern, and that's profits for the owners of capital. And the way they do that is capitalism controls the means of production, which includes the human means of production, the labor. Now, that's not a criticism, okay? That works beautifully. I'm not criticizing it. But you have a major force there that will treat people badly. The problem with our system today is the other major force that's meant to counter that so that we have a balance is government. Government's job, single job, is to ensure equal access to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when government is corrupted by business and money, you don't have that countering force. And the people, the workers, suffer. And that's exactly where we are today. We need to fix government. Remember, I said that capitalism's job is to control the means of production. You don't trust the master who controls you to solve your problems. That would be really foolish. It's not human nature.
All right, go ahead, Raj. let Raj jump in here because we're going to run out of time. Go ahead, Raj.
Well, I just disagree. I mean, I've been a business school professor for 35 years. I very much know what's being taught and what the theories are. It is not working beautifully. It depends how you define what working. You said capitalism is working beautifully. Yeah, what is it doing to our future on this planet? Okay, it's actually putting our entire existence here at risk because of a single-minded pursuit of one thing. You know, business is not a math problem that you pursue this one thing. Business is a complex, living, interconnected, interdependent organism, and it has real consequences on the real lives of real people and the future that we all share on this planet and other species. We're living through the fifth mass extinction in the history of this planet, the first one largely caused by human activity. All the other things that have happened to nature, right? Everything else we're all very aware of. Capitalism, in the way that it has been practiced predominantly, has done a lot of good things, but it is not working beautifully because of all the negative things that it has done. And we have hundreds of examples of companies that are doing it with a different mindset. There are conscious leaders like Paul Polman, who came into Unilever 12 years ago and had a radically different idea to make sustainable living commonplace. And if you look at his 10-year tenure, you know, he transformed that massive company. He inspired change in hundreds of other companies. He delivered superior shareholder returns. He did everything simultaneously, right? So it is possible for companies to do that, and we have not just one, hundreds of examples of that. So I think this is, you know, what Gary's talking about is a formula for really us getting stuck, and we are heading at 60 miles an hour to the edge of a cliff. We cannot continue that. And, you know, capitalism, in that sense, is killing itself because it refuses to some people within the system refuse to change. And if they don't evolve, everything evolves except the hardcore capitalists. They refuse to evolve.
Robert in Richmond. Keep it tight. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks, Evan. I think your premise in the opening arguments was false. You painted the hourly worker as being heavily penalized versus the salaried worker. We don't know the work history or the employment history of that hourly worker. We don't know whether this was the first or the 25th time that she's had unfortunate incidents hold her up from getting to work. That's it. Thank you.
Robert's referring to a story of a company called AppleTree in which a CFO, who's one of the 15% of salaried workers, hit a pothole, was able to use the AAA membership to get over to their Mercedes dealership, pick up a loaner, get to work, and was given the, oh, we're so sorry for you treatment, versus the hourly worker who hit the same pothole and gets 3 hours late to work, gets warned that they're going to get fired, pay is docked. I don't know, Robert, everything about that. What I do know is that the CEO of AppleTree felt that story was strong enough to move him to make change in his own company. I don't know, Raj. I mean, it's true. We don't know. I haven't seen their files, but I don't think John Ratliff makes that change unless he thinks that that is at least representative of a common experience for American workers, which is seeing sort of a caste system in their own company.
Listen, when you've got $400 in the bank, 50% of people have less than that, okay? I mean, this is James Baldwin again. I'll reiterate that quote. Not everything that is faced can be changed. Nothing can be changed until it is faced. If we are unwilling to look at the reality of life for the vast majority of people we employ and how we treat them and how we pay them, then we will simply never make any progress. We're choosing to be like ostriches. So what John Ratliff did was he started a program called Dream On. He said, I know there are potholes in life, right? And I don't want your life to get derailed for that reason. And they made a bunch of other changes, too, to improve working conditions and pay people. But they also said, if something happens in life, we want to be there for you. And they set that up. And, you know, for 10 days, nobody responded. And finally, a woman responded saying, I'm so sorry, but I need help. You know, my ex-husband stopped paying alimony 2 weeks ago, and a week ago I got evicted with my two kids from our apartment, and I've been living in a car now for a week. And I just can't do this to my kids anymore. I'm so sorry, but I need help. And John Ratliff sees this, and he's, you know, he's moved to tears, and he just said, I felt a deep sense of shame. He said, what kind of a leader am I? What kind of a company am I running? I've got a mother who works here full-time, right? And she's homeless for a week, and she still couldn't bring herself to tell us that. And, they got her into a hotel that night, and they found her an apartment, helped her with the first month, last month, which are hurdles many people cannot get over. And then they said, you know, if you want, we can keep this confidential. And she said, no, nobody has ever done anything this nice for me in my entire life. And she told us, so, of course, the word got out, and before you know it, there were dozens and dozens of people who came forward with equally sad stories. Other people were homeless. They were dealing with all, you know, if you could see a thought bubble over the head of everybody you meet today in your company, it would break your heart what they're dealing with. And it's simply a matter of human, you know, treatment to say, let's open up our hearts. The two most common things in the corporate closet are unexpressed human caring, which, because we're not allowing people to do that. You're supposed to show up and be professional and win market share and defeat our competitors, right? So we harden our hearts when we go to work. So unexpressed caring and silent suffering are the two things we're locked away. Let's bring those out. Let people express their caring in service of that suffering, and we will elevate existence and we will create healing organizations.
Raj Sisodia, the author of The Healing Organization, Awakening the Conscience of Business to Help Save the World. Andrew Brady, quick, where can people get in touch with you, the organization, and learn more about what you're doing with him?
ConsciousCapitalismROC.org, or find us on Facebook and join us Wednesdays throughout the month of July at 3 p.m.
Andrew, thanks for making the time and making this happen for us. And Raj, great to meet you. Thanks for making the time for the program.
You're very welcome, Evan. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Andrew. The book is The Healing Organization. Thanks from Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a peaceful weekend. We'll talk with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.